March Madness has begun. Xavier University is the only Greater Cincinnati team in the men's NCAA tournament, but plenty of local fans will be placing wagers on teams from across the country using betting apps on their smartphones. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss the growth of sports betting in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, and the impact of that growth, are Northeastern University Public Health Advocacy Institute Executive Director Mark Gottlieb. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Thank you.
And WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Dan, I want to get a sense for how big sports betting has gotten. What's the total wagering look like in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana?
$16 billion. It's a huge industry now. Those are 2024 numbers that I just added up the other day. And $8.9 billion of that comes from Ohio, $4.7 billion from Indiana, $2.6 billion from Kentucky.
Wow, those are big numbers. And Mark, this widespread legalized sports gambling is still relatively new. How has it gotten so big so quickly?
Well, I think that the main driver is that states are longing for ways to collect funds without raising taxes. So, what they're using for revenue here is actually public losses. And nationwide, we're talking about almost $150 billion wagered, almost all of it online nationally in 2024. So it's an extraordinary amount of money that Americans in about 38 states have been putting at risk. So it's quite an extraordinary and rapidly growing form of, quote, entertainment. But unfortunately, it sometimes goes a little beyond entertainment for many people and becomes a serious problem that causes all sorts of problems like addiction, bankruptcy filings associated with lower credit scores, less investments, domestic violence, and a whole order of other issues that really, in our view, makes it a pressing public health concern.
Mm. And we will get into all of those issues as we continue with our conversation. Dan, I want to ask you, though, with so many companies entering these markets so aggressively, what kind of enforcement do states have, enforcement laws or enforcement mechanisms do states have in place to make sure these companies are following the law?
Well, it depends on the state. Ohio and Indiana both have fairly robust enforcement efforts. I would say Ohio is probably more aggressive when it comes to regulating the behavior of sports books. They've done some stuff related to, how they present themselves in advertising. They've cracked down on athletes being contacted by bettors, passing new rules to discourage that kind of behavior. Last year, they initiated a $400,000 study to figure out different ways of getting people to actually use the responsible gaming tools that are available to them so they don't develop gambling problems. Of the three states, I'd say Ohio is probably the most progressive, and Indiana is kind of right there with them. They have a lot of enforcement actions that they take annually. If you look at their annual report, they'll list them. There are dozens of them that they take. But then you got Kentucky, which is a fairly laissez-faire regulator. Until recently, they only had one person in gaming compliance statewide. And when they started sports betting in I think it was 2023. They staffed up. They hired, I think, 10 and planned to hire 14 when the market launched. And then during the last year, they've gotten rid of all those 10, and they recently advertised for four new positions as the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission kind of cedes to a private corporation, and they're kind of restructuring their approach to regulating gambling in Kentucky. And right now they don't have very many people in enforcement at all.
Mark.
Dandy, are you saying that in Kentucky there's maybe more than $1 billion that is wagered and only less than a handful of folks overseeing this?
I am saying that, yes. 2.6 billion is the total for Kentucky in total handle, all the bets placed in 2024. And as recently as last month, there was exactly one person in gaming compliance. Now there's a supervisor of sports betting. There's an attorney who has some experience in licensing and overseeing enforcement efforts. So there's probably plus or minus a handful, maybe five people who actually oversee the industry in some way, but they are very lightly staffed, according to, a comparison that we did a few weeks ago.
Wow.
We're talking about the growth of sports gambling in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana and the impact of that growth. Do you have questions or comments? Call 513-419-7100 or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Mark, I want to get your thoughts about enforcement. I mean, do you think enforcement is adequate? I mean, based on your reaction, I'm guessing you don't think it is in Kentucky, but even in states that are more progressive, what's your view on enforcement that's happening, and are there violations that you see across the country?
Well, I do believe that many regulatory bodies, usually called gaming commissions in states, have to deal with a number of enforcement issues that come up, and it varies in volume from state to state. I'm in Massachusetts. There's a reasonably robust enforcement, but I think the whole regulatory structure and safety structure around sports gambling, online sports gambling, is built on this responsible gaming model, right? These are this is a sort of industry self-regulation where they set aside resources and make available tools so that people, once they are finding themselves experiencing serious harm, can do things like self-exclude or talk to somebody about it. But all of these approaches that are encompassed in the regulatory structure are all about helping people once they've already been harmed. And our public health approach to this is that we need to have preventative policies that will prevent harm, putting up guardrails to prevent people from falling in the river and then having to rescue them when they're drowning, and stop signs and lights to slow down the pace of the action so that fewer people experience those problems. So I think there's just this fundamental problem with the way that we're addressing the harms from sports gambling. And of course, it's not just the gambler that experiences these harms. There's For every person who is experiencing a gambling problem, there are a number of people, somewhere between usually five and eight, in their inner circle, in their family, who they work with, who are also affected others, if you will. And I don't think we're really contemplating the scope of the harm for those individuals who do experience what's called a gambling disorder, an addiction to sports gambling. And it's estimated by the American Gaming Association to only affect maybe 1 or 2% of users. I suspect that and we've certainly seen studies recently, one in the Journal of the American Medical Association, that shows that the numbers of searches for around gambling addiction on search engines have increased dramatically over the past several years, which really indicates that we're not seeing everybody who is experiencing harm, and probably undercounting the number of people who are affected.
I want to say here, if you or people you love struggle with problem gambling, you can call the National Problem Gambling Hotline at 1-800-GAMBLER. Mark, I know your institute has filed suit against DraftKings, which is one of the big names in this industry. What are you alleging in that complaint?
Well, this is a deceptive marketing class action. There was a sign-up promotion that DraftKings ran in Massachusetts. They no longer run it here. They run it in other jurisdictions where the ad said $1,000 bonus for new customers signing up to DraftKings, and it was advertised heavily on television, certainly on internet banners, on their landing page, in their app, and it required, in order to get the $1,000 bonus, new customers would have to initially deposit $5,000, and then gamble $25,000 in a limited period of time on certain types of bets. And then if they did that, they wouldn't actually get $1,000 that they could use. They received credits on the platform to gamble more. And we allege, and our clients are alleging that this was not at all clear at the time that they signed up for the service. And they were deceived, and so we're asking DraftKings to make good on their promise and stop these types of promotions. Hmm.
There is big money at stake for these sports betting apps, Dan. What did you find out about how much revenue these apps get from every dollar that people wager?
We just compared in the data from three states, and we found that the seven apps that are active in all three states, Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, they keep between 6.5% and 12.4% of every dollar wagered. The rest they pay out in, you know, winning bets. And, you know, there's a whole art to this, or a science to it, in terms of how you keep your hold percentage. That's the industry term for how much you retain from each bet. And so, one of the things we did was we looked at FanDuel's recent investor conference, where it bragged about different techniques they use and how much effort they put into keeping that hold percentage high. They have, I think, the nation or the industry's highest hold percentage. It was about 12% last year. And they're trying to get that to 16% by 2030. And so they do things like parlay bets. They're like a market leader in, when it comes to these multi-leg bets, where you have to get several things right in order to win. Bettors love them because you can get a big payday if you're right about everything. But sportsbooks love them because almost nobody is right about it every time. So they tend to be profitable bets. As a matter of fact, FanDuel, and their most recent annual report, said 2% of their 13.8% profit margin last year was due to parlay betting. And so they do that. You know, they'll send bonuses. They call it distributing generosity. They send bonuses to bettors to try to entice them to bet more often, be more loyal customers. And, you know, they're finding that this results in a higher hold percentage, more profitability, and they think they can grow that over time.
Dan, if we could just talk frankly about what they're actually doing here. I mean,
yeah,
this is a known addictive product, and they are finding ways to increase, as you call it, say, the hold percentage or the revenues generated. All that is public losses, and they're using artificial intelligence-generated parlay bets, in-game parlay bets, based on the proclivities of individual users, because they collect all of the data that they can on every single one of their online customers. They know when they bet, they know what they bet on, and all of that feeds into the AI generation of parlays designed to attract more money faster from every single user. It's a really predatory business model. And it, you know, most of our work prior to taking this on several years ago has been on taking on the tobacco industry in court and in policies. And there is so many similarities and overlap between the tobacco industry playbook and what the online gambling industry is doing. It's quite remarkable. And in both cases, it's a business model that's built on leveraging the addictive qualities of the product that they're selling.
Yeah, well, I think FanDuel would certainly argue against that. One of the things they shared with us was that they have responsible gaming tools, including a device they call My Spend, which allows you to track your spending over time. And they say that about half of their customers, 3.5 million customers, downloaded this or used this feature of their app during the NFL season last year. They say they're in it for entertainment value. That's what they're trying to provide their consumers. I know there's evidence contrary to that based on, you know, allegations that they use VIP hosts to, you know, to reward bettors and, you know, try to encourage more betting, whether or not those bettors can afford it. And there's evidence that they limit the bets of successful bettors, although they say they're not doing that. They're trying to keep dishonest players, I guess, from that's my word. That's my description of what I've heard from, you know, betting companies. But they try to keep sharps, as they're known, successful bettors, from abusing the system and, you know, trying to upset their risk analysis on every bet. And they say if they're not able to do that, they're not going to be able to offer bets at competitive lines, betting lines that give gamblers a chance to win money.
Because no doubt that would affect their hold percentage, right?
Yes, it certainly would. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to stop you all
they
right
also
there.
Avoid bets.
Yeah. We've got a lot more to talk about. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. And later in the program, we'll discuss whether Hamilton County's stadium sales tax should help pay for a new arena. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about the growth of sports betting and the impact of that growth on Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. My guests are Northeastern University Public Health Advocacy Institute Executive Director Mark Gottlieb and WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Dan, Mark mentioned before the break that the sports gambling is a way for states to get tax revenue. What kind of revenue are these states getting from this sports gambling, and how does it compare to other places?
Well, Ohio got $169 million in tax revenue from sports betting in 2024. Indiana got $43 million. And Kentucky, $38.6 million, for a total of $251 million for all three states.
And what do they typically use that revenue for? Do they have programs? I mean, how does that work?
A small percentage usually goes to responsible gaming. As a matter of fact, Kentucky has never had a dedicated revenue source for problem gambling initiatives. And they pass that with the launch of sports betting. And so that $38 million is going to go toward training counselors who can help people with gambling addictions, and then also a kind of a preventive campaign, like a media campaign or some kind of a public service campaign to get the word out about the risks of gambling addiction, whether you're dealing with sports betting, horse racing, or whatever. And so the state is now taking bids from contractors who would provide those services using this new funding source. The rest of the money in Kentucky goes, so that's 2%, I think it's 2% of the total, so 2% of that $38 million. The rest of the money goes toward pension contributions in Kentucky.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other states, I guess they also funnel some money to problem gambling programs.
I think each state does between 2 and 3%, Ohio and Kentucky, and I'm not really sure how they use the rest of the money.
Okay. Mark, we've talked about how much this legalized sports gambling has grown in just a few years. How has lobbying factored into legalizing sports betting?
The lobbyists for the industry and the individual companies, the platforms themselves, are the primary source of information that legislators in various states hear from. And they're often the stakeholders that get the most attention from the regulators in each state once it has legalized sports gambling. So I think that unfortunately the policymakers and the regulators don't really have as full an understanding as would be optimal to make these policy decisions about how these products should be placed on in the marketplace. And that's one of the reasons, Lucy, why we've been at the Public Health Advocacy Institute, very happy to work with Congressman Paul Tonko and Richard Blumenthal on developing federal minimum standards that all states would need to follow in order to continue to offer legalized sports gambling on something called the Safe Bet Act, supporting affordability and fairness in every bet is the acronym that SAFE stands for. And last week, it was introduced into the 119th Congress. I was there with the senator and the congressman at a press conference in front of the Capitol. And this would address issues such as marketing, preventing things like bonus bets, odds boosts, things that draw people back in when maybe they want to slow it down. Affordability checks so that if people are betting like $10,000 a month, the platforms would need to make sure that they have the means to afford that so that people don't find themselves bankrupt and spending, for example, their mortgage payments on sports gambling, and also restricting the use of artificial intelligence in tracking player data and developing marketing and individual bets for players using AI. And our hope is that, you know, having those uniform minimum federal standards throughout the country will compensate a little bit for the unevenness that we find from state to state and make it sort of an even playing field for all of the companies so that they're all following the same rules.
And obviously, we don't have those uniform federal standards yet. Mark, do you see, as you look at how state policymakers are handling the potential harms with gambling, do you see any differences in between that and how they've handled harms from addictive substances like nicotine, which your institute has worked on, or opioids?
Well, it's really interesting. American Psychiatric Association and the World Health Organization, for example, have found that gambling is an addiction. Gambling disorder is an addiction in the very same category as opioid use disorder or tobacco use disorder. It's the only one addiction that is in that category, which is not a substance or chemical that enters the body, but incredibly, it has the very same effect on the neural pathways of the brain that a chemical or drug does. It's an extraordinary cause and effect that, you know, engaging with gambling products changes the brain the same way that opioid use would. And unfortunately, I don't think our regulatory agencies at the state level or the legislatures who are giving the green light to these operators really understand that yet. We're all kind of using this paradigm that had been the dominant one for decades, that this is a compulsive behavioral issue, not an addiction that affects the brain the same way that that drugs or chemicals do. And I think as we and this has been since 2013 when the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, recognized this. And it's I think it's long overdue for regulators and policymakers to understand that this isn't a compulsive behavioral issue like, for example, kleptomania, that this is something that's a little bit different and requires the type of regulation that is due to an addictive substance or product like opioids or even, nicotine products.
Well, I've been talking with Northeastern University Public Health Advocacy Institute Executive Director Mark Gottlieb and WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Thank you both so much for your time today and for this important conversation.
Thank you so much.
And again, if you or people you love struggle with problem gambling, you can call the National Problem Gambling Hotline at 1-800-GAMBLER. Up next, should Hamilton County's sales tax help pay for a new arena? This is Cincinnati Edition.